The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. I'm Liz Elliott from the North Carolina Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Oprah Magazine, July 2019, Volume 20, Number 7. This is the first of three installments of the July 2019 issue. On the front of this month's cover, we see Oprah ready for a party. She's on a veranda and she's got on a light yellow cable knit sweater and some khaki pants and sunglasses on, and she's got a white tray in her hand with three yellow cocktails with some lemongrass stalks sticking out of the top, and she's smiling out over a green landscape. And in the top left-hand corner, there's that same lemongrass green color in the rectangle that pictures the white Oprah logo. That's almost a perfect circle with an oval cut out of the center. There's no quote on the front cover this month, but it has a little arrow pointing to the drink, and it says, "My favorite drink for my favorite guests." It also advertises articles like "The Books I Can't Wait to Read This Summer" and "What Your Therapist Really Thinks About You, A Shrink Tells All." And when we move to the behind-the-scenes section of the cover, there's another picture of Oprah on that veranda holding those drinks. It's just from another angle, and we see all of the beautiful plants in her yard. And just beneath the photo is the title of the article saying, "Be My Guest." Over the years, I've become quite the entertainer, if I do say so myself. Sharing a home-cooked meal with friends and family, it doesn't get better than that. Well, maybe if you throw in a good cocktail to toast the occasion. My favorite party starter is a drink we call Maui in December, and despite the name, I love it year-round. It's part zesty from lemongrass and ginger, part fruity from pineapple-infused vodka. Yes, I'm a tequila fan, but vodka comes a close second, and 100% refreshing. Sipping it surrounded by people I love, just as the sun is going down, that's my definition of happy hour. And Oprah shares her recipe for Maui in December. This recipe makes two cocktails plus extra infused vodka. The ingredients are one large pineapple, two lemongrass stalks, root ends trimmed and outer leaves reserved for garnish, one 750-milliliter bottle of vodka, three mint leaves, two thumbnail-sized slices peeled ginger, 1/4 cup chamomile tea, chilled, and 1/2 cup lemon juice from about 2 lemons. Step 1. Cut off and discard top and bottom of pineapple. With a serrated knife, remove skin. Cut flesh into quarters. Slice out core from each. In a blender, place 2 pineapple quarters. Blend until smooth, then strain through a fine mesh sieve into a bowl. Transfer to a glass jar and refrigerate. Step 2. On a grill or a stovetop grill pan over medium-high, place remaining pineapple and lemongrass. Cover and cook 4 to 5 minutes on each side. In a large canning jar, place smoked pineapple, lemongrass, vodka, and mint. Cover and refrigerate for 8 hours or overnight. Step 3. To make cocktails, muddle ginger in a shaker and fill with ice cubes. Add 1/2 cup infused vodka, 1/2 cup reserved pineapple juice, tea, and lemon juice. Shake and strain into chilled martini glasses. Garnish with lemongrass leaves and serve. There's a side note that says pure and simpler. Don't have time for steeping, smoking, and soaking, or searching for lemongrass? This modified single serving tastes just as sweet. And there's a small recipe that reads, muddle 3 mint leaves and 1 thumbnail-sized slice of peeled ginger in a cocktail shaker until no large pieces remain. Add 4 ounces pineapple juice, 1 ounce lemon juice, 2 ounces vodka, and ice. Shake well and strain into a martini glass. Garnish with a pineapple slice and serve. And just to the side, there's a little column with three pairs of sunglasses. And the caption under that column reads, I spy sunnies to keep you stylish from dawn to dusk. The first pair is a squarish cat eye combination in a tortoise shell. And they can be found on warbyparker.com. They list at $95. Beneath that, there is another square pair, a little bit grayer, still tortoise shell, but more in a gray tone. Peepers by Peeper Specs. They list for $25, and they can be found at peepers.com. And on the bottom, there's a third tortoise shell pair. A warmer tortoiseshell with much darker lenses and more of a rounded shape with a bridge. The bridge on this pair is a little wider than the other pairs. And they are by Zach. They list at $125 and they can be found at ZachEyes.com. That's ZAKEYES.com. And now we move to the Here We Go section. This is Oprah's opening letter every month. And about three quarters of the page is taken up with a giant picture of Oprah relaxing on a green rattan sofa. And it's beautifully upholstered with a leaf pattern cushion and some throw pillows and a big natural buffalo and check pattern, natural and white buffalo check pattern. The room is stone and there are giant casement windows looking out into a fern-filled yard. There are variegated pothos plants planted just below the casements in almost a planter style. And there is a table upholstered beside her, kind of covered in a buffalo check pattern with a lamp and a planter and a phone on it. And there's a natural sisal rug. And Oprah's relaxing on that sofa with a book called The Gift of Nothing. And she's got a white blanket over her lap and her little dog beside her. And the caption inside that photo reads, you'll find passionate recommendations for brilliant new titles just in time for your travels, even if you're traveling only as far as the sofa. And her opening letter reads, we're in the midst of that glorious season when we move a little slower, laugh a little easier, and linger a little longer. The lingering is extra wonderful when we are engaged in an activity we love. For me, that's reading. And that's why every year I look forward to O's July issue when we bring you our annual summer reading guide. This year, as always, you'll find passionate recommendations from brilliant new titles just in time for your travels, even if you're traveling only as far as the sofa. But you'll also get a privileged peek into the creative processes of women writers we admire, with a look at the sometimes unusual, sometimes ordinary, always meaningful objects that inspire them as they work. We're also offering up the most fun and flattering style trends of the moment. Recipes for that marvelous bumper crop, sweet corn. And a celebration of the particular joys of bringing food and friends together outdoors. Here's hoping it all helps making the living easy this summertime. Enjoy! And now we move right into the July annual reading guide. And it's titled this year, The Women of Summer. There's a big opening page, and there's a collage of all different kinds of pictures and writings. There's some tweezers and some metal implements and a big pair of old metal scissors. There's a small caption that reads, Sarah Collins assembled a collage of ideas in her writing room, including photos of 19th century dissection tools, a quote from Jane Eyre, and various 17th century paintings. And in the center of the page, beneath the Women of Summer title, there's a paragraph that reads, this season, the biggest, juiciest, smartest, saltiest reads have sprung from the minds of writerly dames, both established and emerging. Their words resonate with power, with empathy, with humor, with rich and twisty plots, with insight into where we are now and how we got here. But our 2019 Summer Reading Guide doesn't merely gather their exciting new works. It also shares the personal talismans that inspired them as they wrote. Because behind every great book in this issue is a great woman with a story to tell. As we move to the next page, the margin is surrounded by different types of memorabilia, like a red feather boa and costume jewelry, and a little Algonquin card for Mr. Stanley E. Gilbert, and an old postcard for Radio City Music Hall. And the caption here reads, Elizabeth Gilbert's memorabilia from the Big Apple of Yore included feathers from a Siegfried girl's headdress and her father's Algonquin hotel card. And now we move to a selection of four books and their descriptions, and the first is City of Girls by Elizabeth Gilbert. Whether taking us around the globe on an expedition of self-discovery, Eat, Pray, Love, or devising a heroine to rival Charles Darwin, the signature of all things, Gilbert is an audacious literary adventurer, always finding new ways to celebrate the daring. Her latest novel is a billet doux, to up for anything showgirls in 1940s Manhattan, as observed by a starry-eyed protagonist named Vivian Morris, who loses her innocence many times over, learning the ropes from the other vamps in her aunt's raucous Midtown theater. Gilbert's aim, she confides in a letter to readers, was to produce a book that would go down like a champagne cocktail. Drink up! Our next review is for Big Sky by Kate Atkinson. The best-selling author of the consciousness-bending novels Life After Life and Transcription here revisits broody former soldier Jackson Brody, the detective she introduced in the 2004 novel Case Histories, as he comes out of semi-retirement to take down a sex trafficking network. Our next book is The Tenth Muse by Catherine Chung. The cliché that boys are better at math collapses before the diamond-hard mind of a grad student whose relentless attempt to prove a legendary hypothesis exposes a deeper algorithm about herself. Chung spins her captivating novel from stories of actual women who, in her words, posed as schoolboys, married tutors, and moved across continents, all to study and excel at mathematics. Our next book is The Confessions of Franny Langton by Sarah Collins. Collins's propulsive spine tingler uses the conventions of historical fiction, but infuses the genre with edgy beauty. Accused of the murders of her employer and his wife in 1826, crimes she can't recall, Franny awaits her fate in a London gaol, narrating her trajectory from Caribbean slave to possible villain. Collins molded Franny after Francis Barber, Jamaican servant and eventual heir to Dr. Samuel Johnson. In her deft hands, defiant Franny summons courage and cunning to tell a story of colonialism, racism, and the yearning to connect. As we turn the page in our book review section, we see an entire page covered with different pieces of paper and books. We've got a notepad, a copy of To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee, a roadmap of Alabama, a peacock feather, a death certificate from Alabama, and different books and newspaper clippings. And on the following page, we see another little grouping of objects. It's a metro card on top of a celestial map and an old retro postcard of New York and a telescope, an old brass nautical telescope. And at the bottom of the page, there is another grouping of objects. It's a picture of a woman playing guitar and a backstage press pass from a rock concert in an old paper day planner and a guitar pick. All of these are different little groupings of objects that inspired some of the authors of the following books that we're going to review. And the first is Fleischman is in Trouble by Taffy Brodesser Ackner. Star New York Times Magazine staff writer Broda Ser Akner says the idea for her electric novel came to her when a not-yet-divorced but already-dating friend shared a racy selfie he'd received from a lingerie-clad woman. Click! She dropped into a coffee shop, pulled out her laptop, and began a novel about Toby Fleischman, a doctor whose wife has split, leaving him to deal with their kids and the neighborhood moms who now see him as the bachelor. Despite the domestic chaos, he still manages to fit in time for old friends and semi-anonymous sex. Broda Ser Akner's first foray into fiction, set in Manhattan, the Hamptons, and Israel, is funny, stylish, and insightful, whether describing men's challenged communication skills or the knife juggler's agility required to maintain a modern marriage. The next book is Mrs. Everything by Jennifer Weiner. Spanning from 1951 to an imagined 2022, the Good in Bed author's ambitious and uplifting 12th novel follows two sisters who learn to defy society's and their parents' outdated expectations of relationships and the partners we choose. It's spurred by Weiner's mother coming out as gay in her mid-50s. Weiner felt compelled to tell a version of her mom's tale, to portray what life was like for two generations of women, and to show how far we've come and how far we've got left to go. Our next book review is The Summer Demands by Deborah Shapiro. After a miscarriage, a woman nearing 40 inherits an abandoned New England summer camp and moves there with her husband, intending to turn the property into a resort. While walking the acreage, she discovers a squatter, a directionless and heartbroken college student, who goes on to soothe some of the wife's aches and uncover others. Shapiro's second novel is a blistering profusion of desire and longing, revealing the undercurrents between our younger and older selves. Next, we read about No Walls and the Recurring Dream by Annie DeFranco. Like Patti Smith, DeFranco is an auteur for whom music just happens to be one form of expression. Her exhilarating memoir, A Profile in Creative Ingenuity and Persistence, is a feminist manifesto come ode to experimentation in life and art. Among its many penetrating riffs, I have transformed my pain into something more beautiful and useful than it was in its original state. Our next book review is about Furious Hours by Casey Sepp. A generation after she published To Kill a Mockingbird, Harper Lee traded Manhattan, where she'd hold up, hermit-like, for her native Alabama, to sit in on a stranger-than-fiction trial, vowing to write her own in cold blood. Among the blood-curdling elements were a string of corpses left in cars, and a preacher-turned-killer who was then murdered himself. Sepp delivers edge-of-your-seat courtroom drama while brilliantly reinventing Southern Gothic. As part of her process, she immersed herself in the region's vibe, filling her shelves with books by Faulkner, O'Connor, and Hurston, papering her walls with maps, timelines, death certificates, and autopsy files, and listening to Johnny Cash. The result is an enthralling work of narrative nonfiction, Sepp's debut, and a poignant meditation on a book that never was. On the next page of the annual book list, we find another collection of objects, like a yellow rotary phone and a digital handheld recorder, some cards, a high school graduation picture of a young lady, a police badge from the city of New York, some handwritten letters, an old dried corsage, and a ticket for an REM concert at Madison Square Garden from June 23rd, 1995. And on this page, we have four book reviews. And the first is called Ask Again, Yes, by Mary Beth Keane. In 1973, two Irish cops are thrown together as partners in the NYPD. One moves to the suburbs with his wife, and the other quickly follows, buying a house in the same neighborhood with his new bride. Keane's is an Updikean epic of intertwined families destabilized by grief and estrangement following a mother's breakdown, then redeemed by their enduring compassion for one another. Our next book is entitled I Like to Watch by Emily Nussbaum. No longer is television a sketchy additive that corporations have tipped into the cultural tap water, a sort of spiritual backbone weakener, opines the Pulitzer Prize-winning New Yorker critic in her judicious and jocular debut essay collection. To read Nussbaum's indelible musings on the boob tube, a two-decade-long argument about television, including her never-before-published pieces, is to view the medium in all its glorious potential, hubristic pratfalls, and transportive magic. The next book is Lifelines by Heidi Diehl. Arising in part from Joseph Auber's pioneering idea that our perception of colors shifts based on their proximity to other hues, Diehl's richly textured kaleidoscopic Künstlerrahmen centers on a wistful painter returning to Düsseldorf, Germany, where 3 decades earlier she fell in love and emerged as an artist to attend her former mother-in-law's funeral. Our next book is The Gone Dead by Chanel Benz. The past shadows Billy when she goes back to Mississippi after 30 years to extract the truth from the riddle of her father's death. Benz's taut, voltaic novel was sparked by Henry Dumas, a southern black poet shot by a New York City policeman in an apparent case of mistaken identity, whose artistic genius was later championed by Toni Morrison. The next page includes a collection of objects, including a little doll and a copy of the album The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, a few books, one from Toni Morrison, and a snow globe with 2 golden birds on a little golden branch on the inside. And those objects inspired the author of the first of our next 5 books, and that author is Nicole Dennis Benn, and her new book is entitled Patsy. The heroine of this sumptuous second novel is a 28-year-old woman who leaves her young daughter behind in Jamaica to pursue the American dream. Dennis Benn ingeniously humanizes and changes up the typical immigrant saga. Patsy's fantasies of a fresh start, including pursuing a crush on a childhood friend, a woman now married to a man. The story came to Dennis Benn in the form of a confession from a mother who seeks to reinvent herself in the U.S. and revel in the freedom to love the way she wants. The result is a knowing, at times painfully funny, novel about the disorienting relationship between selfhood and sacrifice. Our next book is Rough Magic by Laura Pryor Palmer. Aimless at 19, Pryor Palmer cast my rod into the depths of Google as if the internet might contain my future. She alighted upon the Mongol Derby, a 10-day, 621-mile semi-wild horse race. On a whim, with just 7 weeks to train, she boarded a plane to East Asia and stuck a tentative foot through the stirrup. What unfolds, Cheryl Strayed-like, is her thrilling gallop to the finish line. Our next book is Searching for Sylvie Lee by Jean Kwok. From China to America to the Netherlands, Kwok's piercing, inventive novel tracks the fates of an immigrant woman and her children following a disappearance and highlights the sandpaper frictions between East and West. Kwok comes by her story honestly, When my brilliant and generous brother vanished in a plane crash, an invisible hand crushed my lungs, she has said. My heart will never stop searching for him. Our next book is The Paper Wasp by Lauren Akampora. At her high school reunion in small-town Michigan, Abby, an art student turned supermarket cashier, reconnects with Elsie, now a starlet getting her first profile in Vanity Fair. Abby's obsession with Elsie goes from spark to flame, and what follows is a hypnotic tale of codependence that skewers our fascination with gossip and fame. It's probably not a coincidence that Akampora's in-real-life reunions are attended by alum Chloe Sevigny. The next title is How Could She? By Lauren Meschling. This wily send-up of New York City's high-flying media elites proves that hell is a party filled with velvet-clad single men. A trio of 30-something BFFs drift apart and back together amid ego-bruising soirees and dubious alliances. Meschling poses the age-old question, do men work better as soulmates or accessories? The following page is another collection of objects. In the center of the page, and most of the page, is taken up by a very decorative framed certificate of marriage. There are tiny crocheted shoes. There is a Polaroid picture of a group of older ladies and a black and white picture of some older ladies holding a little baby. And another black and white snapshot of a mom and her baby, more crochet, an old brown crock, an old quilt and an old apron, and a big cast iron pan. And these were all objects to inspire Deb Spera to write her book, Call Your Daughter Home. In this vibrant, polyphonic first novel, set in South Carolina in 1924, three protagonists, the wife of an abusive man, a former slave, and a plantation matriarch, combat the sinister legacy of their community. While fleshing out her tale, Spera tapped memories she's long savored like a plate of oven-warm biscuits, of her great-grandmother's aprons, of the cast-iron pans her mama used to bake peach cobbler and gave to Spera as a wedding gift, of the aunt and uncle who cooked a roadkill alligator. Like Jill McCorkle and Sue Monk Kidd, Spera probes the comfort and strength women find in their own company. Our next grouping of objects looks to be an old Rolling Stones album and a Chrissy Hynde album and some sheet music and some Bible verses. And this is a group of objects from Regina Porter. And her book is entitled The Travelers. Porter's audacious first novel in stories traces the intergenerational fates of multiple black and white families from Jim Crow to the Obama era. The great thrill of her innovative storytelling, think A Visit from the Goon Squad meets Homecoming, is in the way she makes the seemingly discrete pieces fit together. Finally, the book asks, what do people take with them, and what do they leave behind? Our next grouping of objects is actually just a pile of sticky notes, several piles of sticky notes, in fact, different colors with handwritten notes on them, and a handmade month calendar. The calendar is just months written in blocks, and there's little notes of what happened in each month under the block. And the caption says, to keep track of her characters' comings and goings, Claire Lombardo arranged hundreds of stickies on her office wall, and the book she was tracking so carefully was The Most Fun We Ever Had. The author wrote her debut novel on a rickety wooden picnic table repainted by three generations of her family. It's currently red. That heirloom is an apt metaphor for the fictional Sorensen tribe, two maddeningly in love parents, four wildly different sisters, and the one secret son one of them gave up for adoption. Lombardo's satisfying multi-course feast begins when a sister, not the mother of the boy, blindsides her siblings by bringing him to lunch. Our next book is entitled Leaving the Witness by Amber Scora. A la Tara Westover's Educated, Scora's pensive, ultimately liberating memoir chronicles her formative years as a Jehovah's Witness, a life in waiting that included a sham marriage, covert missionary work in China, and eventual shunning by her religious community, and captures the bewilderment of belief and the bliss of self-discovery. Writing stitched the narrative arc of my life back together, Scora says. Her book is a suture for anyone searching to reconcile their past and present selves. Our next book, Paris, 7 a.m., by Liza Wyland. Although the poet Elizabeth Bishop kept extensive diaries throughout her life, the 3 weeks she spent in Paris after her college graduation are unaccounted for. What had she been like then? Wyland wondered. She was trying to figure out so much. How to be a writer, whom to love, where to live, how to navigate a foreign country, and the growing threat of World War II. Fittingly for the artist at the Story Center, Wyland's novel, about Bishop's time in the City of Lights, is an achingly introspective marvel of lost innocence. As we turn the page, the next grouping of objects, very interesting. There is a little baby doll and a red kerosene lantern, a catalog of chairs, a pamphlet from a historic walking tour, and a jar of pennies. And these are objects collected by Lori Ray, and her book is entitled Gone Too Long. Roy's intention was to write a thriller set in a fictional Georgia town with historic ties to the Ku Klux Klan. 4 months into the project, in August 2017, the Unite the Right rally erupted in Charlottesville, Virginia, and the novel took on added urgency. Roy's story of a missing girl and the Klan-connected woman who solves the mystery of her disappearance is a cliffhanger to the end, and a potent cautionary tale. Our next novel is entitled Disappearing Earth by Julia Phillips. In her pulsating debut, Phillips conjures the rugged landscape of Russia's Kamchatka Peninsula, excavating a collective trauma triggered by the kidnapping of two sisters. The seed for the book was planted by a pair of decades-old crimes, the abduction of three young women in Ohio, a boy's murder in Minnesota, and the chilling notion that sometimes the monster you dread is right next door. Our next novel is entitled Donna Has Left the Building by Susan Jane Gilman. Fearing her only achievement in life is sobriety, a 45-year-old failed punk rocker and mother of two takes an impulsive road trip to relive her youth. The author's grandfather once told her there were only two truly great works of fiction, The Odyssey and Don Quixote. With her riotous and tender second novel, Gilman delivers her own windmill-tilting sojourn with a woman at the helm. Our next book is by Joyce Carol Oates, and it's entitled My Life as a Rat. The prolific doyen of American letters delivers a riveting story about how a hate crime sunders a family. Oates was influenced in part by an unlikely muse, the Niagara River. She grew up not far from its formative whitewater rapids. In the novel, the river that flows inexorably to its precipice bears her characters towards a reckoning with their own biases and betrayals. Our next novel is entitled Rules for Visiting by Jessica Frances Kane. 40-year-old university gardener May Attaway still lives at home with her father, and is generally more at ease with plants than people. Her plan to rectify that? Embark on a Jane Austen-inspired quest to spend a fortnight or so traveling to reconnect with long-lost friends. This spirit-warming saga, an antidote to the uncivil, is a novel to be read again and again, whenever one needs a reminder to seize the day. The next page has a collection of older objects, look to be Art Deco era, several books and pieces of pages, plus a picture of a woman and a little child, and a book entitled The Lesbian Community by Deborah Goleman Wolfe, and a round frame with a black and white picture of a man inside. And these are all objects, it says in the caption, that Naomi Wolfe kept close. Books and articles her mother and grandmother wrote, a 1997 photo of Wolfe with her daughter, and a portrait of one of Wolfe's subjects. And all of these objects were near her as she wrote her latest book entitled Outrages. When the beauty myth author returned to school at 47 for her doctorate, her Oxford professor handed her a volume of letters by an obscure mid-19th century essayist named John Addington Symonds and said, "You really should read this." Those documents became the basis for Wolfe's dissertation and this long overdue literary investigation into censorship and the life of a tormented trailblazer, a prescient father of the modern gay rights movement. Our next book is entitled Conviction by Denise Mina. Years after a traumatic event in her adolescence prompted Sophie to relocate and change her name to Anna, it seems life as an Edinburgh housewife and mother holds the peace she's long been seeking. That is, until her husband and best friend take off with her kids, and a revelation in a true crime podcast has seismic repercussions. Written after the death of Mina's own son, this thoroughly au courant thriller from a master of tartan noir is a page-turner with depth and soul, and proves the truth that a lie never lives to be old. The next book is entitled Grace Will Lead Us Home by Jennifer Barry Hawes. Even as Pulitzer Prize-winning Post and Courier journalist Barry Hawes co-wrote an early newspaper account of the massacre of 9 black congregants at Emmanuel AME Church in her hometown of Charleston, South Carolina, she knew she was just scratching the surface of a much deeper story. In heartbreaking detail, this tour de force of reportage contrasts the goodness and bravery of the victims with the actions of the dead-eyed killer on a mission of hate. And our final review in the annual July book review is entitled 1919 by Eve L. Ewing. The genre-busting poet-scholar behind Electric Arches and Ghosts in the Schoolyard combines assiduously researched facts and bracing lyricism in this elegiac exploration of the 1919 Chicago race riot and the summer song folk who were its human cost. I like to use poems as what-if machines and as time-traveling devices, Ewing says. You'll want to join her on this ride through a piece of black history too often left out of textbooks. That wraps up the annual book review, and now we'll move to the feeling good section and an article entitled The Secret Lives of Therapists. Ever wonder what she's thinking and writing on that clipboard? LA psychotherapist Lori Gottlieb tells all. When I tell people what I do for a living, I brace myself for awkwardness. A therapist? Should I spill my guts about my childhood? People who say that are kidding, but also not. Then there's, can you help me with my mother-in-law problem? And, are you going to psychoanalyze me? The answers, by the way, are Please don't. Possibly, and why would I do that here? If I were a gynecologist, would you ask whether I was about to give you a pelvic exam? Of course, I understand the curiosity. Before I got my clinical psychology degree and started seeing patients 10 years ago, I wondered about my own therapist. What's going through her head as she listens to me talk about the thoughts swirling in mine? Is she judging me? Does she like me? Are there things she isn't telling me about me? Wait, did she just stifle a yawn? Therapists can be as confounding as they are helpful. So, pull up a chair and let's chat about what everybody wants to know. First, how do you decide what personal information to share? Most therapists nowadays aren't what Freudians call blank slates. For example, we might tell a patient how an interaction with her makes us feel, especially if it's a behavioral pattern that shows up in her relationships outside the office, and we want her to become aware of those patterns. Or we may bond over a TV show we both like. Better to admit I watched The Bachelor than feign ignorance and then name-check a character you haven't mentioned. We'd rather be a regular person than a cipher, but we are strategic. One therapist I know told a patient whose child was diagnosed with Tourette syndrome that she also had a son with Tourette's, and it deepened their therapeutic relationship. Another colleague counseled a patient whose father had died by suicide, yet felt it too personal to reveal that his own father had died the same way. Even just mentioning our families can be unhelpfully distracting. A patient distressed over infertility might fixate on her therapist's 3 kids, for example. In each situation, we weigh the risk. Is this information beneficial to the patient? Or could sharing those details be perceived as inappropriate or self-indulgent? We are taught to avoid the latter, which could cause a patient to shut down or even flee. Do patients ever bore you? A counseling session isn't a cocktail party. I'm not expecting to be entertained. What makes therapy interesting is seeing people at their most human and figuring out how I can help them. If I think someone is droning on, I try to get her to see how she's talking around the very reason she ended up in my office. The patients who don't hold our attention are the ones who won't share the details of their lives or their real feelings, who avoid answering our questions or go off on tangents when we try to focus them. It's wearying when a patient wants to keep me at bay. Let me really see you, and in that moment, you'll become the most fascinating person in the world. Are there patients you just don't like? A patient may not necessarily be someone I naturally choose to meet for a latte. Not that I could anyway. Befriending patients is unethical. But I admire that she's trying to grow and change, and my job is to keep her with that. I also know I'm the person people rely on to listen to things they can't tell anyone else for fear they'll be criticized or disliked. Sometimes I hear extremely upsetting stories, like that of the former alcoholic who long ago drove drunk and killed a mother and a child. But instead of condemning, I have to be very conscious of my role in helping the patient deal with regret, sadness, remorse, despair, and shame. Once I get to know and understand my patients, I feel genuine affection for them, their tender places, their bravery, their souls. What are you like outside the office? Many people find it jarring to imagine or actually run into their therapist out in the world, in the same way kids find it strange to see their teacher in the supermarket. When it happens, we won't initiate contact. It's our job to protect patients' privacy. But therapists are often the ones who feel more uncomfortable when our worlds collide because we've seen our patients' real lives. They haven't seen ours. We're a lot like you, actually, but we try to be our best selves when we're out and about. Here are some things we can't do in public. cry to a friend, argue with a spouse, impatiently press an elevator button like it's a morphine pump, honk at a driver who could be a patient, blocking the entrance to a parking garage. Why won't you give advice? One thing that surprised me when I became a therapist was how often people want to be told what to do, as if right and wrong answers exist for the bulk of the choices we face in our daily lives. Taped up in my office is the word ultra-crepidarianism, which means the habit of giving opinions and advice on matters outside one's knowledge or competence. It's a reminder to myself that, as a professional, I can help people sort out what they want to do, but I can't make their choices for them. Sometimes a patient wants someone else to come to a decision so she doesn't have to take responsibility if things don't work out. But my role is to support her independence and help her come to her own conclusions, which I realize can be frustrating. Despite what I know from grad school, training, internships, and my work with patients, I've even asked my own therapist for advice. Once he responded, "I only know what I would do." My reply, "Okay, then just tell me, what would you do?" Not surprisingly, he kept mum. He let me make my own decision, and it worked out fine. Which was exactly his point. I needed to learn to trust myself. Why do therapists say so little? In movies and TV shows, the mute counselor has become a cliché, but there's a reason we let the silences linger. We know that it's often in silence that people can truly hear themselves. Talking can be a good distraction. Too good, in fact, because it takes people's minds off feelings that can be frightening, upsetting, or overwhelming. Sometimes, too, my office is the only place a person can cry uninterrupted. And whether that's a noisy honk into a tissue or a more discreet weeping, it's still a kind of conversation, even if no words are exchanged. I've had a patient come in after landing a hard-won promotion or getting engaged who can't find the words to express the magnitude of what she's feeling, so we just sit together in silence, beaming. Just because therapists aren't talking doesn't mean we aren't working. We're focusing very intently, listening and processing. This requires a lot of energy, which is why I try not to schedule many back-to-back sessions. I take breaks in between to refuel with a snack or chat with colleagues. Can't we just Skype? This makes sense in some cases. Say, if a patient is traveling or in crisis and can't come in right away. But it's not the same as talking in person. Face-to-face, we're attuned to visual cues. The tapping foot, the subtle facial twitch, the clenched fist. That can sometimes tell us more than the patient's words or tone of voice. But equally important is the shared energy in the room, the joint experience of sitting in close proximity in the same quiet space. Plus, video chat also presents the risk of technical difficulties. I was once on a Skype session with a patient in Asia, and just as she began sobbing, the sound cut out. Then our connection dropped. It took 10 minutes to restore it, and by then the moment was lost. Are there things you're thinking but not saying? Yes, because in a session, as in life, timing is everything. I might want to point out a pattern I've noticed, but bringing it up too soon might make you feel judged or ashamed. So I'll tag it in my mind, and then I'll wait until I think you're ready to work with it. There's also an arc to every hour, and we don't want to have someone stop mid-cry and say, "I'm sorry, but we're out of time." You might have noticed your therapist glance at the clock, but it's not because she's impatient. She knows she'll need 5 or 10 minutes at the end to either put you back together or give you some things to think about during the week. How do you feel when a patient leaves you for another therapist? I don't take it personally, because study after study shows that while training, years of expertise and area of specialty are all important to the success of treatment, the key factor is your relationship with your therapist. So, if someone isn't feeling it with me, I hope she'd bring it up so that we could better understand what's going on. Sometimes the issue has to do with the way the patient relates to people in general, so she'd likely have the same concerns with another therapist, in which case it would make sense to try to push through and address those issues specifically. And yes, I'd feel disappointed if she left before I could help her do that. Overall, though, we want clients to be motivated to work with us each week. If that's not happening, we should encourage them to see someone else. The ultimate goal is always to prepare that person to leave you. When someone gets better, we're happy they don't need us anymore. But the truth is, we still think about them after they're gone. That article was written by Lori Gottlieb, and she is the author of, most recently, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. And we've got time for one more quick feeling good article, and this one is entitled Acupuncture for Dogs, Bone Up on the Facts About Alternative Medicine for Your Pet. 4 in 10 of us routinely use treatments like yoga, herbs, meditation, Reiki, and massage to cure what ails us. And now some of these are going to the dogs. Experts say complementary therapies may help pups of all sizes, ages, and breeds who are suffering from discomfort of the body or mind. Just be sure to check with your vet before proceeding. Veterinarians understand not only the potential benefits, but also the potential harm an alternative treatment can cause, says Jerry Klein, DVM Chief Veterinary Officer of the American Kennel Club. Plus, they should be attuned to what's best for your particular dog. Treating a 6-pound geriatric Pekingese with metabolic issues can be different from treating a mostly healthy 3-year-old Newfoundland, notes Klein. If your vet isn't open to thinking outside the box, Klein suggests getting a second opinion or consulting the American Holistic Veterinary Medical Association, which can be found at ahvma.org. A group of vets who advocate for the use of integrative medicine. Here are some popular alternative therapies for four-legged friends. Acupuncture. You get pricked to nix a nagging ache. Acupuncture is effective for neck and back pain, osteoarthritis, and frequent headaches. Your dog can go under the needle, too. It's been recommended for musculoskeletal pain, arthritis, asthma, allergic dermatitis, traumatic nerve injury, and some GI and reproductive issues. It may be well worth a try. In a study following 181 dogs for up to 24 weeks, Brazilian researchers found that regular acupuncture reduced musculoskeletal pain in the vast majority of cases. And note, worried about keeping your pup still while he's being poked and prodded? Dogs generally become very relaxed, most likely because of endorphin release, says Ernie Ward, DVM, founder of Doggone Healthy, a nutritional and behavioral care practice in Calabash, North Carolina. Ward says licking or pawing the needles is rare. CBD. You drop a tincture under your tongue or rub a cream on your lower back. Trendy CBD or cannabidiol, a non-intoxicating compound in cannabis, is used to self-treat everything from anxiety to chronic pain. Your dog can swallow a pet-formulated tincture or a doggy treat made from one of the many brands flooding the market, such as Honest Paws, Dope Dog, and Charlotte's Web. Products like these are promoted to address pet ailments like pain, anxiety, and seizures, but the specific data on CBD use is sparse, says Tina Weismer, DVM, Medical Director of the ASPCA Animal Poison Control Center. Preliminary findings from a study at Colorado State University did show that 89% of dogs with epilepsy had less frequent seizures after receiving CBD. A larger study funded by the American Kennel Club Canine Health Foundation is now underway. Note, consult your vet first. Start with a low dosage, then keep a close eye on your pup. Some dogs have developed signs of toxicity after ingesting CBD products. It's difficult to tell whether they might also contain THC, which can be poisonous to animals. Call your vet immediately if you notice your pet acting lethargic or disoriented, or walking or behaving strangely. Massage. You go for a monthly session to relax your muscles and nerves. Your dog is always up for a good rub down. A vet specializing in rehab might recommend massage to reduce pain and improve range of motion and circulation. Note, if the therapist is too rough, the body work could wind up worsening an injury, warns Klein. Sensitive dogs may also react by biting the hand that needs them. Klein suggests seeking a certified canine rehabilitation practitioner or a vet that is certified by the American Veterinary Chiropractic Association. They're trained to get pets back on their paws. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope that you've enjoyed it. I'm Liz Elliott, reading for the North Carolina Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.